Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to this edition of A Climate Hawk's Companion, a podcast that gives thoughtful people some information and background to help better understand the complex world of global warming. So, as a climate hawk, you know that climate change affects literally everything, from the weather to medicine to the way we live our lives, right? Right now, climate can be kind of scary, kind of depressing. It's an overwhelming issue if you start to think about it. What are you going to do? It's a big issue. Seems to me that art is one way of processing the big issues of our lives and our times. If you look back through history, over and over again, art has mediated the big issues of the day. But with climate change, it seems the issues come upon us so quickly that the diffusion of the reality into art has barely begun. So the question that I thought would be interesting to talk about today was, what's the connection, the interplay between art, writ large, however you conceive of art, and issues like climate change and sustainability? I mean, how do they touch each other? I don't think there's a right answer to that question, but it's a good question to ask and to wrestle with. So, because the link between art and sustainability is so big, we thought that the most useful thing would be to go find a real-life artist to talk to. And we have been extremely lucky to find one. We're talking today to Roseanne Walsh. How are you doing, Roseanne?
I'm fine. Thanks, Ted. Thanks for having me on.
It's great to have you here. Before we begin our discussion with Roseanne, let me just tell you where she's been and what she's done. Of course, she has a BFA from the Rhode Island School of Design, RISD, if you've... You probably heard RISD more than even Rhode Island School of Design, but it's a prestigious school known nationwide. She's got an MA in education from Lesley University. And she says about her paintings that they're figurative allegories that explore the perceived personal responsibility for changes in the social order, and about her own personal relationship with the unparalleled spectacle of the natural world. Now, I think, let me just put words in Roseanne's mouth before I let her speak, but I think that her artistic vision is much bigger than a narrow sustainability idea. But the issue of sustainability and environmental issues infuse into the work, and they're in there somehow. And so we're delighted to have Roseanne help us exploring this thing. Hi, Roseanne, how you doing?
I'm doing great.
Good. So tell me, Roseanne, did I get completely backwards? I won't even say did I get it anywhere near right? Being a physicist, I'm not very artistically inclined. But I mean, what do you think?
Well, the thing is that with sustainability, I think when I was making my work, I wasn't necessarily thinking about trying to teach people how to be sustainable. I wasn't trying to make my work as propaganda for advocacy. But just because I have such a deep connection to nature itself, that theme,
it comes through, right?
It definitely became, it always just started coming through. I think that the first time I realized that I was beginning to work with that theme was when I was living by a pond. I lived in a property that had a small pond on it. My daughter was always playing with frogs, big bullfrogs. I mean, she just loved collecting bullfrogs. And we became very involved with this little ecosystem that we had in our yard. And, then I read that frogs were being born with deformities because of pesticide runoff. I think that was the first time that I ever really, beyond, growing up with Smokey the Bear, don't start forest fires, and, it's not nice to fool Mother Nature, that kind of don't be a litter bug stuff. I think that was the first time that I really felt you know, like a little bit of an emergency happening, mm-hmm. you know, like the amphibians were being affected. And so then
how do you process that? If you say, as an artist, you say, I see this thing going on. I mean, clearly you're not going to draw. Well, I mean, what was your artistic response? Was it to sort of fake left and go right? I mean, to try and approach the subject from a different perspective?
No, it was a lot simpler than that. I mean, frogs just started showing up in a lot of my work, you know, frogs' legs. I mean, I guess it was pretty literal, but I was just using frog imagery, and I had, you know, a self-portrait of myself kind of coming up from underneath the water with these dead frogs. I mean, it was all just very, whatever happened, happened,
right,
you know.
Right.
And, you know, I was working abstractly, making a lot of collages and mixed media work, where I was, you know, a lot of times with art, you know, you kind of don't want to hit people over the head with your message. You want to make it, you want people to be attracted to it in some way, look at it, and then have them figure out their own interpretation of what they're looking at.
Right.
You know, which is different than, like, you know, political illustration, where you really, you know, you're making it very crystal clear.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right up front, you know, easy to grasp in 2 seconds.
Yeah, and I mean, there's all different approaches. There's all different kinds of ways of making art. And for me, I guess it just was a little vague at first. I was really working.
What do you think is the unconscious sort of processing? How does that play in an artist, not in this specific case or even specifically with you, but you probably work with a lot of artists. You see stuff that they're doing, and maybe you can connect to their life or something that they are affected by that they haven't figured out yet. Do you think that happens very much? Or would you subscribe to that for yourself?
Well, I have a friend that does a lot of abstract work, and she's very formal in her approach. It's very much about the language of art. You know, she's just approaching making a piece of work based on, you know, one stroke following the next stroke, a very organic process, which actually making abstract work, in for me, made me feel closer to nature, because it made me feel like, you know, the doubt of, does this look like what it's supposed to look? There is no what it's supposed to look like.
Right.
You're just responding to the next thing that happens. And it makes you really aware of the process of creativity. And so when you look at, you know, I like to look at things like pictures of cells under a microscope, you know, real close-ups of fish scales, things in nature that, when they're blown up like that, when you can really see the way a peacock's feathers are connected together, or just you know.
I mean, it's funny you should say that, because it's a bit of a reverse. The screensaver on my computer are NASA satellite photos of the Earth. Right, so now it's a reverse, it's a big scale shrunk down.
Sure.
But you see these patterns, you say, whoa, where is that? Right? So all of a sudden you start seeing connections that you hadn't appreciated before.
Exactly. I love aerial photography. Looking at National Geographic magazines, I've had piles and piles of National Geographic magazines that I've at one point or another decided I've got to get rid of these. So before I could do that, I had to go through them all and, you know, pull out all the good pictures. And, you know, then they're completely out of context for what the article was, but they resonate with me completely, purely on a visual level. Looking at them that way, just, you know, spreading out a whole table of images from National Geographic and not trying to make any sense other than responding to them. What goes with what, what's like what, putting like things together, you know, and somehow a story just starts to evolve out of that process, and you start to find what you're interested in. And the more I did it, the more I found that I was just interested in kind of the power of nature and its ability to kind of adapt to any kind of change that gets thrown at it. But, you know, that's fine for it. Is it really fine for us?
Right, at the expense of some of the creatures
in
there.
Exactly. I mean, there were dinosaurs at one point, and they're not here anymore. And so,
That you've painted, there is a painting I saw of yours that had, there were sort of bees in the background and a woman in the foreground.
Right.
What painting was that?
That, I call that the last roundup. And it's the last roundup. It's kind of a play on words from roundup, the pesticide, the genetically modified, whatever. Everybody uses it.
Yeah.
And so, in the picture of the woman, she's sort of like, worn out. She's just like, she's had it. Behind her, her farm is dying. There's a storm cloud. There's a, kind of clouds, stormy clouds right. coming on. She's got a ring of daisies in her hair, obviously. Well, for me, that is kind of a thing that I used to always do when I was a kid and when my children were little. And it's just like symbolic of a person who's connected to nature. And the bees are falling out of the sky dead. And, if you know anything about what's going on with Monsanto and Roundup, I think it makes sense. But I think for a lot of people, it's just a pretty picture of a nice lady with bees. And what are those? What's happening with the bees?
But don't they ask? I mean, isn't it a? I mean, it must be. I've seen it. It's a conversation starter, right? You say, okay. If you don't have the sort of background to know about Roundup and the threat to bees, which I agree is a completely legitimate threat, still in awe, you have to say, okay. What's the point, right?
Exactly. So it is. It's exactly that. It's a way of engaging somebody who maybe is attracted to the pretty girl in the picture. Maybe they find her face arresting, and then hopefully they're gonna think about what it could possibly mean. And for me, I know that a lot of people, when they're trying to get a point across in art, just like with music, they can go about it in a bolder way than I have done. Mm-hmm. But I think, it's not my style mostly because I don't appreciate looking at that. I like beautiful looking pieces of art. I like beautiful sounding music, and I think that to attract people who might just walk away from something that's bold and in your face. This way you can maybe capture somebody who will not be intimidated to ask somebody, well, what does it mean? Explain it to me. And then you can kind of bring them on board with it a little bit. Mm-hmm. And hopefully they'll come to see that, maybe they should be paying attention to the choices that they make in their lives,
I think it's one of these things where it's one... I mean, everyone is on a journey towards sustainability, whether they know it or not, and they are all taking little baby steps, right? And, of course, everyone wants to be that last baby step when the light goes on, right? But you look at a picture, and, it stays with you. I mean, there's another picture you have of a woman, and she seems to be holding a pine branch
tree stumps.
Yeah.
She's standing in front of a forest that's been chopped down, that's been completely eradicated. And there's, one tree left that she's protecting. She's sort of like guarding it, like she doesn't want. She's going to protect that one last tree. And, there's this big storm happening in the background. Again, I've got this thing with skies. But, that came about because of the whole butterfly decimation with the forest in Mexico that's been cut down. And, I have another one that I didn't hang next to it, which is of a butterfly sort of flying away with high heels on. I don't know why, but had high heels on. But, I ended up not hanging that one up. But, the idea behind that was just that, that she's too late. Her anger's too late. Mm-hmm. And I think, for me, mm-hmm. I feel like everything I do is too late because I don't even find out about things until it's a big problem. And I think that a lot of people, we don't know that people are chopping down forests and that it's going to affect the butterfly population until a scientist tells us, and then it gets reported, and then we read it, and then we go, now what?
Yeah.
And,
Well, I think,
now you have to plant milkweed all over the place, right? That's the next thing to do. Well, there's always something.
I guess you're right. I mean, there is this idea of the precautionary principle in environmental science, right? Is that saying if you don't know what the consequences are, don't do it, right? And if the precautionary principle were fully embraced, they might not be chopping down the trees with the butterflies in it. But you're right, humankind is mostly behind the eight ball playing catch up when they find out after the whole micro beads
facial scrub.
I mean, what is this? Anytime you see CeraVe or something I've seen. I mean, it's ceramic, right? Little micro beads of ceramic in the stuff that make your face beautiful and glowing, but aren't so good for the fish or something, right?
Well, and who would have thought? I mean, it never really occurred to me that there were little pieces of plastic in the stuff that I was rubbing on my face. Mm-hmm. I assumed it was some sort of seed or like, oatmeal or something healthy because, I don't know.
That's what you want.
Why?
That's
because I didn't read the back of the product, obviously, right? I mean, there's just, you go through your day and the amount of times you are lazy. For me, I mean, there are people I know who are just doing amazing things at being sustainable and making all the right choices and being very conscious. But I'm just more and more aware that I'm not that person and I want to be that person. But I also remember when I had my first child 28 years ago and I was going to use the cloth diapers and I was using the cloth diapers and using the cloth diapers and it was not fun. But I was dedicated to it. And then I forget what terrible disaster happened that year, but, something akin to, like, the Exxon spill, where, and I was like, what? I'm here, like, washing out poopy diapers, and they're just blithely, filling ocean with oil. So it can feel like
overwhelming.
It can feel overwhelming and like nothing you do is going to work, but I maintain that we all have to do something.
But I guess that's the perfect. I mean, to come back to the role of art. I mean, how do you capture that in some way that's not obvious or didactic or somehow hitting you over the head, right? In a way walk away. I mean, it's a tough one. I mean, it's that kind of, digestion of the information and bringing it back so people. Well, tell me this. So let me a different question. Who have your heroes been in this journey? I mean, you clearly think a lot about art, have seen many, have studied art. I mean, given where you are now, who has influenced you to get here?
Well, so many people, and not just in, not just the medium of painting. I started when I was at school. I was an animation major, and so animation is, something that I think, everybody loves it. It's huge now. I mean, everybody goes to see animations, and, even children's books. I started off as an illustration major. I wanted to be a children's book illustrator. Then I switched to animation, but I think that there's so many different genres of art that it's hard to even say which one impacted me the most. Mm-hmm. I think I was mentioning to you earlier about, The Lorax, how now it's a movie, but of course it started off as a book. The Lorax, here was somebody who clearly, obviously felt passionate about saving the environment. And he wrote this book to appeal to children, but also hopefully to appeal to the people that were reading the book about the Onceler. I mean, the terrible Onceler. And, we're all Oncelers now. Every one of us is a Onceler. But I mean, so Dr. Seuss was doing what he needed to do to try to get the word out. And then you see movies like WALL-E, the movie about the robot, and he's left on the Earth and full of trash, and then the rest of the Earth's population is just huge fat people whose vertebrae are disintegrating because they just roll around all the time. It's hilarious, but sad. It's a funny movie, but it has a real message that hopefully kids.
I think that that kind of stuff, stays with you much longer than the sort of beat you over the head with eat your peas kind of message that environmentalists often think they have to send out. I mean, again, it's back to how do you translate a message in a way that gets to people when they don't expect it to, right?
Right.
And it's a well, Tony, you we were talking before about an artist named Andy Goldsworthy.
Oh, Andy Goldsworthy.
And I took a look at his web. I mean, a really marvelous structures and stuff.
Oh, glad you liked it. I'm glad you liked it. He, to me, when I look at his work, mm-hmm. I feel like he's a child out in the woods playing, just like how I remember playing when I was a child and how I wish all kids still played now. That's a whole other topic, but his work...
They can't go out because of the Lyme disease.
They can't go out because they're playing a video game or they're afraid or whatever the reasons are that people keep their children inside all the time now. But anyway, his work is, he goes, he finds a place, and then he uses whatever is there. If it's a certain kind of leaf, he'll pick all the leaves and he'll make a trail in the woods, or he'll put sticks together in such a way that they float on a pond and then pull berries off and arrange them. And he's just really, he's making art with the very nature itself and then photographing it. And I just find it to be incredibly spiritually beautiful. You know, I can imagine that he's having an incredibly spiritual moment while he's making it. You know, it seems like a gift.
Yeah, I mean, you look and say, how could he have put that together with with pieces of stuff, I guess you say, that he found right there?
He uses thorns. He'll take thorns and weave things together using the thorns.
Oh, really?
Or he'll use his own spit to make ice pieces stick together. It's amazing. He won't use any other materials. He's great. He's now starting to do things where he has done things that are more permanent in nature, like a stone wall up at Storm King right here in the Hudson Valley, Storm King Park. He's made a stone wall that goes around the trees, so it sort of is like a snake. It goes all around the trees, so when you walk along it, you know, you're sort of interacting with these trees that come in and go out on the other side of the wall. It's really nice. I love him, and
again, you're back to the idea that you're not getting hit out, you're being charmed by the content, and you walk away and 2 days later you say, yeah, you know, those trees were really worth keeping track of, right?
He makes you appreciate nature. He makes you stop and look. Stop and think about it, you know, the fact that, you know, there are a wide variety of colors in even the same kind of tree, you know, from yellow all the way to red over time. He does a beautiful job with making you appreciate being in nature, even when you're not, when you're just looking through a nice coffee table book, which is usually how people experience his work. It's kind of how people experience most artwork, I think. I mean,
true enough. Do you think it's different between the actually seeing a painting in front of you and seeing as faithful a reproduction as you want to pretend you've got?
Oh yeah, I love the Hudson River School of Painters. Are you familiar with them? Do you know who I mean?
Well, these are the guys, they're sort of 1820s, 1830s, and these beautiful landscapes of rivers
gorgeous
and mountains. Gorgeous, sumptuous kind of Americana.
Americas before it was populated, and they would have, big mountains with massive skies. And, you know, in my art history book, it looked great. I loved them, you know. Nice big color plates, really great. But then I went to go see it in person at the at Olana, which is the estate of Frederick Church in the Catskills, and the paintings were incredible. They were just magnificent. I mean, it was just, those kind of paintings just make my heart open up, I don't know how much of America's culture really spends the time seeking out those experiences, though. That's the sad part. You know, I think we have a very small art audience compared to, say, for example, you know, people who watch the Super Bowl.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah.
I mean, you know, it's a, to try to reach people through the arts sometimes feels like first you got to get them to look at the art, you know.
Right. Yeah,
And to get people to look at, to get people to appreciate, you know, climate change and what's going on with our planet, I think one of the big problems right now is I just don't think people spend enough time outside anymore. I think that not enough
jump
people...
in the car and they drive to work, jump in the car, come back, go in the supermarket, come home and watch TV.
Right. And kids, if they're outside and they're active kids, they're usually on a manicured square kicking a ball, you know, they're focused on the ball. They're not just out freely roaming and, you know, playing and making mud pies and, you know, forts and things.
I think
that, to
I
me,
need to
are
do that again.
Really cool.
I'm going to go back and start having a happy childhood and do play mud piles all day. That
well,
would be
you played on
me.
The beach, didn't you?
Ah, yes, I did. I so did indeed. Well, Roseanne, I really want to thank you for taking the time to come in and chat. What I'm going to do is put up the link to your website, which has some of the pictures that we talked about.
Okay.
I urge people to go take a look. They're beautiful. And I think that I hope, Roseanne, we can have you back on as you continue to explore your art. And because, I mean, this whole issue of climate and art isn't going away anytime soon, and it's only going to evolve and become more and more interesting. So I want to thank you very much. What I'll do is I'll tell the people listening that they can find the blog, the links that will be in a blog that's associated with this podcast. It's on the Mass Climate Action blog, which is massclimateaction.net/blog. You can find us on Facebook. It's surprisingly enough, /MassClimateAction. You can listen to this podcast on Stitcher, on TuneIn Radio. You can find us on iTunes. We're on most of the major podcast aggregators. So please find us, share us, rank us. It helps other people find the show. So we're going to close where we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we recognize the preeminence of art in helping us solve the climate change, because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the United States put a price on carbon. So, Roseanne, thank you very much for being here.
Well, thank you. I hope I said everything that you...
Oh, you did a great job. And thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Bye, Ted.
Thanks for listening to the Climate Hawks Companion.